Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Blog Talk family. This is Leslie Giss. I'm the host of the Antique E-Show. Today we have a special show featuring a wonderful documentary. It is entitled, Slap the Donkey. We have one of the producers, Miss Adrienne Smith, on the line. Could you introduce yourself, Miss Smith?
Hello?
Okay. Hello.
Yes. Hey. Miss Smith is not available. I'm the writer-director.
Okay.
My name is Eddie Harris. And, I have on the line a fellow producer, Dougie Doug, who's also a well-known actor.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Hi, I'm Leslie Giss, as I said earlier.
Hi,
I've been speaking to Adrienne Smith for the last few weeks about your appearance on the show, on the Antique E-Show. Could you tell us where you got the title of the film, Slap the Donkey?
Okay. Slap the Donkey was actually a term that was coined by Reverend Sharpton during his 2004 bid for the Democratic nomination. The whole purpose, or the whole, I guess, feeling behind slapping the donkey was that the Democratic Party had been taking the African-American and Latino vote for granted. And the Republican Party had been taking their loss for granted. So what you end up having was a sort of disenfranchisement that was occurring inside of the party, where only certain people were being sanctioned to move up, were getting their campaigns funded, were actually getting any sort of power that was conferring to their constituents or conferring to their voters. So Slap the Donkey, we're hoping people will sort of take on, as a colloquialism, should mean, you know, stepping up and making the system work for you.
Okay. All right. Do you want to add anything to his answer?
Well, I mean, the origin of the term comes from Reverend Sharpton's presidential campaign in 2003, where he specifically went out to run for the Democratic nomination, but also against the Democratic Party establishment. So slapping the donkey is originally meant critiquing, confronting the Democrats.
All right. Now, did you guys actually overhear him use this phrase or this expression? How did you learn about the expression yourself?
Yeah, he said it many times during the campaign. It's also in the film as well.
All right. So were you working on his campaign?
Yes. Well, I'm Reverend Sharpton's biographer, so I've been actually following him for about 10 years. And Slap the Donkey is the fourth installment in a series called Rolling with Rev. It takes a look at black leadership at the turn of the century. So, I've been following him for quite some time. And I think that year they did 35 debates. I did about 33 of them. And I traveled with him from start to finish.
Okay, so you seem pretty young. What made you, how did you get involved with politics to the extent that you would follow a candidate like Reverend Sharpton for 10 years and also write a book?
The quick answer is I'm not that young.
Okay.
I got to New York and got into television and was trying to, work the industry like most filmmakers, and just found that there was a lack of critical analysis in our documentaries. You know, the focus was always, gangsters or pimps up, hoes down or something dealing with love relationships. But there was no critical political analysis taking place. So I basically just sort of took it upon myself to, you know, follow one of the most prolific black leaders of our time, with his ups and downs, you know, his shortfalls and his accomplishments, and sort of tell his story, but tell our overall intellectual and political story over his shoulder.
I didn't travel with Reverend Sharpton and Eddie during the campaign. I met Eddie afterwards, and just to sort of define sort of what my role was in this, Eddie showed me the footage of the film, and it's sort of a loose edit of it, and I was impressed by everything that he showed me, and it was clearly a very, very intimate look at something that the average viewer would only get to see from far away. So I thought that I could lend some of my expertise as a producer to work with him together to create a story that could be really compelling, that people would be really excited about.
Okay. And this story is all about Al Sharpton. Now, what year, you said this is a series, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And just for a little more clarification, actually, Stop the Donkey isn't all about Al Sharpton. It's really a look at the black body politic as a whole.
Okay.
Now, in order to do that, we needed a vehicle that could, you know, set up, I guess, or be our string for our series of, analytical storylines. And Reverend Sharpton and his run represented that story thread that we needed to take a deeper look at the black body politic and the amount of power that it confers to black people.
There is also a historical legacy to which Reverend Sharpton is a part of, but not completely emblematic of. He's just a long line of leaders. And so telling his story, inevitably you have to tell the stories prior to him and some stories about his impact. So it's about the past, the present, and the future.
Okay, how far does it go into the present? When does it end? You know, when did you start shooting the film?
That particular film, we actually started shooting the day he announced, and we went straight through to the Democratic Convention that took place in Boston.
What year?
That was 2000. It was 2000, the end of 2002, beginning of 2003 to August 2004.
But also the film highlights the election of President Obama, so it sort of places it, not sort of, it places it within the context of the most recent presidential campaign.
Yes.
Do you think Obama's presidency has bolstered the, the people's interest in this film, this type of film? You think you're going to get a better turnout now that he's president than if you would have released it prior to his presidency?
Doug?
Well, I think that we're getting a lot of response from the film. I don't know exactly what people are motivated by in terms of their interest, but I think that it's important. The story is a different story now that we have an African American president than it would have been had we released it earlier. So I think it has a broader audience because of the presidency, because we also focus on the fact that prior to President Obama, the presidential ambitions of any black candidate were dismissed as merely symbolic or, in the case of Reverend Sharpton, sort of novel. So it sets up the fact that there were many, many steps that needed to be taken, and that perhaps we can re-examine what those steps were within the context of what has happened. Perhaps if future generations continue to try to do the impossible, that despite how it may be perceived, it is likely that if we persist that we're going to break through.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Any other comments? Would you like to make a follow-up to that?
I think he's right on point with that. One of the things that we're hoping is that we put in the proper context the historical legacy that led up to Obama.
Yeah.
And that was very important to us. The Obama phenomenon was actually the result of a movement that has been going on since Frederick Douglass and the Independent Party. So, understanding that, I think, for any community, sort of puts in a better context the role that African Americans have played in the American body politic as a whole, and also gives us an opportunity to understand that with our future leadership, some of the steps that need to be taken to, correct the problems of the past and, improve our political savviness. But you need to kind of understand historically what that means in order to, move forward in an intelligent manner.
Okay. Now, how many African-American presidential candidates did America have? I know that's a controversial.
Good question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
It was three. I'm not positive.
There were more than that.
Yeah, there were definitely more than three. Frederick Douglass was nominated for vice presidency of the Independence Party. You have Shirley Chisholm ran,
right.
Dick Gregory ran, Jesse Jackson ran, Alan Keyes ran. Jesse ran twice. Then you have Al, and I'm missing somebody. There's somebody that I think I'm missing. So there was, there have been
Lenore Fulon, name on the Green Party ticket?
Lenore Fulon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was her name?
Yeah.
Lenore Fulani.
Oh, okay, I remember her name. Okay, so I was just curious because we had a little debate about how many they were prior to Obama. Now,
right.
When we talk about your film, what is one of the things you think people will definitely learn? Like you'll say, wow. I didn't know that as far as history.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think it's a couple of things that will strike people as interesting.
Let's start with the youngsters. Let's say children under 13. What do you think they will come out of the film saying, wow, I didn't know that?
I think that they're going to be shocked to know how many people ran and that a black woman ran. And, these were viable candidacies. And because that, a lot of times the Congressional Black Caucus, which is a, political body, never really fully supported or developed a black agenda that they could then take to the president or, to the Senate to sort of alleviate some of the problems in our communities. So I think they're going to be shocked about that. I think they're going to be shocked about the number of blacks that have actually run. I think that maybe not as as low as 13, but I think the general population will be sort of impressed or shocked to know that Reverend Sharpton and Obama had a relationship in 2004, and then that relationship, has blossomed into, a very viable one. But it was made in the context of, what do we need to do? You're the best shot we have, so what do I need to do? Do I need to block for you? Do I need to bolster you? Do I need to, cover for you? So there'll be a level of camaraderie that I think has been absent from a lot of the political commentary.
A lot of the commentary has been either a sort of a fake feud between traditional leadership and so-called new leadership, that there really is no fight, that there is still political alliances being formed from traditional or older black politicians and the contemporary generation of leaders that operate in this current political climate.
Okay. So you're saying there's a fight that's being waged in the media. Something similar
yes.
to the voice in Booker T. Washington?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it may be schools of thought. There may be different ways to skin a cat, different
mm-hmm.
approaches. But it certainly is no diametric opposition between or personal animosity between separate camps.
So
right.
your film really highlights those points that there was a friendship that was forged between the president and
mm-hmm.
Reverend Sharpton.
Yeah, that's something that definitely you will come out of the film understanding.
Wow, that is impressive. That's very impressive.
Yeah, and also the whole idea of. Everyone has a role to play.
Yeah.
So you have a luminary such as Percy Sutton, you know, conservative consultants like Dick Morris, speaking very, very truthfully about the way they see this world and the way they see the body politic in America. And I think that's going to be refreshing because a lot of times we're so worried about being politically correct that somehow the truth gets lost in our correctness. So I think that people are going to hear very frank conversations about what's going on.
Now, one thing that sticks out in my mind from watching the campaign coverage is that Ms. Reverend Sharpton was a supporter of Hillary Clinton all the way to the end, all the
mm-hmm.
way to Puerto Rico. Does your film show that he could be in both camps with Hillary and Obama? And still, you know, maintain that friendship.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that again?
During the campaign,
mm-hmm.
Reverend Sharpton was campaigning mm-hmm. with Hillary Clinton to the end, even to the point when she wouldn't concede defeat and went to Puerto Rico.
No. Reverend Sharpton didn't support Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
So he wasn't in Puerto Rico with Hillary?
No. He did not support Hillary Clinton. And whether or not he was in Puerto Rico or not, that's more of a logistical thing. I don't believe he was.
Okay.
But at no point in time did he, matter of fact, he stayed quite neutral throughout
yeah.
the whole piece. I think that was very telling, you know, when it comes to how African Americans have to play the game of politics in this country.
Uh-huh.
But no, he never came out and supported Hillary Clinton.
So he was neutral.
Yeah, I would say that he was for the most part neutral for most of the campaign. You know, he had a lot of questions for Obama.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the black community said, well, you know, he's a brother. How come you didn't just jump out there? And he's like, you know, it's not about just getting a black in high office. It's about getting the right black in high office.
Right.
You get the wrong one in there, you end up with like an Idi Amin or, you know, Baby Doc or, you know, a Charles Taylor. So we have to be very careful that we don't play racial politics.
I understand.
But, you know, but we play interest politics like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that Obama would have been given the same type of leniency and understanding if he had played neutral, if Sharpton was campaigning? Or you think he would have been, you know, dubbed Uncle Tom or anything of that nature if he would remain neutral between a campaign which Reverend Sharpton was running against, let's say, a Latino or a non-black candidate if Obama didn't go out and vocally support the black candidate? You think that the black community would have been harsh?
Well, I think that we have a lot of honest dialogue that needs to take place that hasn't taken place yet. And so the level of sophistication just has not been there because in a lot of cases, the Congressional Black Caucus, well-meaning as they may be, have not gotten to the point where they have actually learned to shift the levers of power in Congress. So if you ask anybody, any of your audience, You know, what is something that the Congressional Black Caucus, you know, has done that you know about? I think you'd be hard pressed to find people who would know.
That's true.
Right, you have that on point. So, will your film talk about the Congressional Black Caucus? Would you are you going to you know shed light on the role?
Oh yeah.
Oh okay. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Now, is Maxine Waters part of the Black Caucus?
Yes, she is.
Okay. All right. Is she in the film?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward. Look, before we go into any more conversations, for anyone just turning in or tuning into our talk, give them an update as to what we're talking about, when the film will be shown, and, you know, just the particulars.
Okay. We're talking about Slap the Donkey, which is a political documentary exploring the body, the black body politic at the turn of the 21st century over the shoulder of Reverend Al Sharpton's 2004 run. It'll be screening at the Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem, New York, 124th Street in Frederick Douglass at 7:30. If you want more information or you want to RSVP, there is limited seating. You can go to slapthedonkey2009@gmail.com and reserve your seat. It's about getting some political education.
Yes.
It's about creating a space where we can have critical analysis of our leaders without feeling like we're throwing them overboard.
Right.
Okay. All right. The film. You started, you said, over 10 years ago, following Reverend Sharpton. And then at what point did you decide, you know what, we need to really just wrap this up and get this project done, finished with, and put it on the big screen? When did that happen?
Well, again, this is the fourth installment. The
okay.
other three films, the first one was A Promise Fulfilled, and that talked about how the National Action Network and Reverend Sharpton went to Vieques to protest the Navy bombing.
In Puerto Rico?
He ended up going, excuse me?
Where was that, the Navy bombing?
The Navy bombing was on the island of Vieques, which is off the coast of Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And they were dropping depleted uranium bombs for target practice and was causing one of the largest cancer clusters in the Western Hemisphere. Reverend Sharpton went down there working with Ruben Barrios from the Puerto Rican Independence Party, and they went onto the Navy base and started protesting and got locked up. Reverend Sharpton and Adolfo Carrion, who used to be Bronxborough president, Jose Rivera, used to be Bronx Democratic Party chairman, and Roberto Ramirez. They were known as the Vieques Four. And all of them they all went to jail. The three that I mentioned spent 40 days. Reverend Sharpton did 90 days. And when on his way out, that's when he decided to that's when he announced that he would be running for president, actually. The other film is called Moon Over Sudan, which talked about when we snuck into Sudan to investigate the slave trade in 2001. And we documented people purchasing people. We talked about the genocide. We talked about the fact that British Americans and Chinese oil companies were fomenting the slave trade by using the Janjaweed to clear the land. So that was the second one. The third one, which actually will be premiering at the New York International Latino Festival on Saturday at 6 p.m. downtown at the SVA Theater in Chelsea. It's called Trek to the Holy Land. And that talked about right after the September 11th attacks, Reverend Sharpton led a peace delegation to Israel, where he talked with Shimon Peres and Yasser Arafat about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we visited absorption camps where Ethiopian Jews are sequestered, I guess, and taught new Judaism, taught new language, and then, you know, given jobs to become, you know, Israeli citizens. So that's the third film, and then the fourth one is Slap the Donkey.
Excellent. Sounds like you had you did a lot of work. Now, are there any books that you recommend to go along with the film? Are there any must reads?
Wow.
That you think teachers should, you know, I know that you want teachers to show this film to their students.
Yes.
And you definitely want them to have a companion as far as a book. Have you
In terms of the Israeli Arab
all
conflict,
four.
I just in terms of that, I would recommend Edward Said's Orientalism for students. It's a very incisive examination into the roots of that conflict from the perspective of people whom are not entrenched in mainstream media. So that's a good one. Edward Said's Orientalism.
Orientalism. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Do you have any other books? Do you want to throw out there to the audience?
Well, it's really kind of hard to say. I know that all of this stems from people just being well-rounded about the world around them. So,
well,
you
let's
know,
say,
I
what's one of your favorite books? Maybe may not be directly related to your films, but
mm-hmm.
just one of the books, one of the books you think that students, if they're interested in politics, they should read this book. I don't care if it's old Frederick Douglass's autobiography or...
Right.
You know.
Well, I would say I would have to start off with Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth.
Okay.
That's a must read because it gives you the proper context. And I think it's an easy enough read for, you know, maybe preteens to teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it opens up an opportunity for there to be honest dialogue about the situation that we're in now without, you know, trying to be too idealistic. Another book that I found very helpful, I'm actually reading now, is the biography of Hubert Harrison, who was the foremost radical intellectual from Harlem at the turn of the 20th century. He was a contemporary of Du Bois and Booker T. He was harsh critics of them both because of the way they handled each other, really. And it speaks volumes of how black leadership has not been able to form any sort of cohesive or unified front because of the shortcomings of the individual leaders, be it egoism or what have you.
Now, is there such thing as a white leadership?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a de facto white leadership. They may not call themselves that, but
right.
they organize themselves around principles and around interests that somehow magically help white people.
Right.
But they don't have to co-sign with any particular so-called leader, or there isn't a white leader that's been assigned to the white race. Like Cuomo.
I would say, not officially, no.
Okay.
But oddly enough, they make up a large majority just so perhaps they may not have to in order to organize large numbers of people. They may not have to use the term.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that President Obama, you think he ascribed to the black leadership, or, you know, do you think he went under that guise that he wanted to be a black leader?
No.
No.
Or a white leader?
I think he recognizes black leadership, and I think if he was asked, I think he would acknowledge the necessity of black leadership. Okay. And he recently spoke at the 100 anniversary of the NAACP. I don't think he did that because he doesn't acknowledge black leadership.
Right.
Okay. All right. That's just a question, you know, that I had back in my mind that was just troubling me about the black leadership, that we have to, you know, say we're either with Du Bois or Booker T. And I think
That's what's so refreshing about Hubert Harrison, because we were given that paradigm. Uh-huh. Booker T and W.E.B. were not opposites.
Right.
They were not separate philosophies. They were not conflicting philosophies. They were the same philosophy manifested and treated and dealt with in different manners.
Right.
What Hubert Harrison did, in my opinion, was he expanded the notion of what it means, you know, for radical leadership.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say radical leadership.
Right. And that deals with, you know, they talked about Booker T said, you know, cast down your pail, you know, build your own thing, sort of, you know, accept your classhood. Where, you know, E.B. was like, you know, if you educate yourself, if you teach yourself, then you erase, you know, you erase their ability to say that you cannot learn.
That didn't say Booker
you know,
T didn't want. That's not
exactly.
That Booker T didn't wasn't in favor of education.
Exactly.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
I think that's what he's saying, that their particular philosophies are not in conflict.
Right. Okay.
Right. And what?
So are we doing them? Are we serving them properly by saying both of them are leaders, or should we just say they're both black men doing good for the nation?
Well, I mean, if you want to, to be technical about it, to be a leader means that there are people who are following you.
Right, and nobody wants to be a follower, right? That's what you've been taught.
Right. So, I mean, look at it this way. If somebody is shot, if the cops shoot, if there's another Sean Bell case,
okay.
Notice, Dick Parsons, who used to run Time Warner, or Ken Chenault, who ran, Merrill Lynch, or American Express, right? You know, you couldn't call them up and be like, look, the cops just shot this boy 50 times. What are we going to do? He wouldn't even take your call.
Right.
So you have leading blacks who are leading in different industries, in business and stuff. But a black leader is someone who can say, look, we're going to shut down Manhattan and 100,000 people show up. So if we're not careful, language will confine our own struggle. If we don't take control of the language, you know, then we're subject to being, I guess, duped or bamboozled.
So we should look to leaders. So you, instead of looking for self and thinking that you can make a difference just as much as Al Sharpton or President Obama, you think that we should really look into, like, you know, I'm trying to understand.
Which one is more important to teach?
I think
what he's saying is that leadership needs to be acknowledged as a concept. So leadership exists no matter who's doing it. So whoever's doing it needs to be acknowledged as a leader. It's not about depending on anyone. It's about recognizing leadership in various areas of activity where it exists. So if Al Sharpton is doing it, and it's an area in which we need leadership, then we should acknowledge him as a leader, and those that need leadership should follow him or should support him or whatever.
Right.
But to say that, well, we should be looking to him, we with the big W should be looking, is that I don't think that you can generalize in terms of people's needs. Some should, some shouldn't, some can, some can't. But I think people who are leading and that word should be used when it is appropriate. When someone is demonstrating the qualities that we associate with leadership, we should acknowledge them. It's not exclusive to Reverend Shobden or whomever. It's just anyone who is leading should be acknowledged as a leader.
Okay. All right. Do you want to add anything to that? To what he said?
No, I think that's kind of exactly what we're talking about. You know. And this film hopefully will raise that type of dialogue. You know, what is the interest? What is the agenda?
Right.
Not just the personality. Right. Right. Not charismatic leadership is 20th century leadership.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we have to,
charming.
Excuse me?
You mean it's being charming, charismatic leadership?
Yeah, charismatic leadership. So, you know, it's the good preaching one, the one who can talk that talk, the one who can get us all riled up, you know. And we focus our movement based on that individual. That's 20th century movement stuff. 21st century movement stuff will become, I think, more individualistic. It will become more about getting, you know, your small groups together and doing the things that...
Personal responsibility.
Well, it goes past that, really. It becomes almost economic responsibility. A lot of times, you know, we look at a lot of the immigrant population, they come in like, wow, you know, how come all the Arabs got the bodegas now? You know, how come all of the short order cafes are all Mexican now? It's because they have a philosophy that we're going to do this together. We're going to work this out together. We're going to push this together.
Oh, that's a different show. That's a different show. That's a different show. Let's stick with your film. I'd like to have you back on, and we could talk about why we think the immigrants that come over get a lot of help and are targeting our areas, and why, you know, Harlem has to worry about the influx now of white immigrants.
Okay, that's another show. Yeah, and I wasn't saying that to say that it's something you have to be worried about, but as far as understanding that there are no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests, a lot of times when you get caught up in charismatic leadership, you miss the boat. And the disenfranchisement comes because you haven't changed your tact or you haven't changed the way you decide to confront an issue. And I think that's what the 20th century taught us. And now the 21st century is demanding of us to sort of devise a new program.
Well, yes. I went to a film festival last night in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And a film festival, black film festival, the film that I went to see is called A Place Out of Time. And it's about a historically black boarding school in New Jersey, which is now a juvenile detention center. 400 acres, 30 buildings, most of them built by the students. It was modeled after Booker T. Washington, and it was founded by a former slave. Now, the film talked mainly about the fight between Booker T. and Du Bois. However, at the end of the film, they showed that the school was closed down, not because of the infighting between the blacks and the different philosophies, but it was closed down because the governor used the Brown versus the Board of Education to close them down because they considered it a segregated school.
Segregated school, yeah.
And he closed it down during the summer with a trick veto. But history will say that the school closed down because blacks couldn't work together. There was two different philosophies.
Well, I have to say I disagree with that. Because I don't think, and whenever people make arguments about history and say that there's a single cause, anybody who's saying that any event happened as a result of a single cause is not teaching history correctly.
Because
there are many causes for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be someone who would be thinking uncritically who would be saying something like that, who wouldn't be investigating that story and trying to unearth the truth. As we know, there'll always be people like that. But there's no one cause. There could never be one cause for anything.
Okay.
That's the That, I'm sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. That's the kind of shallow stuff that that too many of us rest on when we're trying to understand where we are and what we need to do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So when we talk about, you know, these different philosophies as being the root problem,
yes.
You find out, especially in the film last night, those are just gimmicks, what you say, bamboozles. We're being bamboozled.
No question.
To say that, you know, the neighborhoods are in shambles because of two different philosophies.
Exactly.
Without showing the outside influences. And I highly recommend that you guys see that film because I think it'll tell you more about the history of our black schools and how many of them, not many, most of them were shut down due to the Brown versus the Board of Education instead of letting them exist. Coexist and giving them equal money, taxation,
well,
with representation.
Right, and a lot of it too boils down to, you know, if you go into certain black neighborhoods, even like in Harlem, there's certain streets, there's certain buildings on certain streets that, you know, on property shut down. You have, you know, bad roads. You have, you know, bad lighting.
Right.
You can always tell the communities that don't vote. They aren't politically active. Because you better believe if people thought that there was going to be a political repercussion from inactivity or any sort of shyster behavior, they would clean their game up. But if you're not involved, you're not a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, and you'll see it grab the donkey, at one point, Reverend Charlton starts rattling off the number of unregistered voters in various states.
Uh-huh.
And it's phenomenal that after everything we went through to get the vote, the sheer numbers of people who just don't engage. So you can't, you know, and everything you do is political. Where you go to school, how much money your school gets, you know, where do you live, you know, what are your... You know, what are your property taxes?
Does your film go into that? Into those
really
aspects?
It doesn't go into those aspects individually,
right.
But in a very broad sense,
right.
You hear that, you know, when you say, well, there are 250,000 just African Americans alone unregistered in one state. You can change the governor. You can change the governor's seat with 250,000 votes.
Right.
Now you have something to leverage, but if you are not involved, then, you know, you have no voice.
Right.
So,
well,
you know, hopefully this film will get people to understand that, you know, if they, you know, and for lack of a better analogy, you know, if you hustle the votes like you hustle, you know, everything else, if you begin to understand politics the way you understand the interplay in the hood, then we become on par, you know, with the people who have the power.
Well, you won't believe it. We're only down to our last minute.
Wow.
Wasn't that fast?
It was.
You know, usually I try to do an hour and a half. I did a 45-minute show. But I should have given you guys an entire 90 minutes. I didn't know we were going to have such an in-depth conversation. Will you come back?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Love to.
Could you guys give your full names again slowly for our listeners? Hopefully we'll have youngsters. I'm going to re-air this show in September. So could you leave your information, your full names, websites, email, phone numbers, everything?
Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, my name is Dougie Doug. I can be reached at DouglasCitizenJ@earthlink.net.
Okay, and my name is Edward Harris, and I can be reached at harlemedit@gmail.com.
All right, and the film, where will it be shown?
And again, Slap the Donkey will be shown at the Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem, at Harlem, USA, on 124th Street and Frederick Douglass Avenue at 7:30 tomorrow night.
And that's Thursday.
Thursday, July 30th. And there'll be other screenings nationwide. We just haven't figured out the scheduling yet.
It was a pleasure talking to you, gentlemen. Please call us back at the Antique E-Show. My name is Leslie Gist, and that's our show for today. Have a good night, gentlemen.
All right. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.